All right, at this time I'm going to qualify briefly. The requirements of chairing a meeting at the Central Orlando Group Saturday night speakers meeting are 1 year of continuous sobriety, have Central as your home group, and attend a group conscience meeting. Again, my name is Michael. I am an alcoholic. I meet these requirements. My sobriety date is July 18, 2011, and Central is my home group. I was never someone who had to drink. I always wanted to drink. I didn't see the point in life if I couldn't drink. And when I came in here, I was not in any way sure that I was going to be able to give this up. I really just came here to catch my breath and save my job. I didn't save my job, but what I did get is by working these steps with a sponsor, is I found a new life, and actually just a life. I didn't have one before, and I owe all that to the steps of AA and my higher power, and I'm very grateful. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
The group has asked me to remind you to please make sure your cell phones are off and to refrain from moving around or talking while the speaker is sharing. At this time, I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker. There are a lot of sayings in AA, and I heard a lot of them when I came in here, but I'm someone that needs to see them in action before I really believe them. One of those is that it doesn't matter how much sobriety you have. If you have 1 day of sobriety, you have more than a newcomer coming in the door. And I didn't see that as really something that could be true. I know that I didn't feel that I could help someone when I first started. But the speaker tonight was someone who talked to me a lot during my first few weeks here. And I was so self-absorbed, it took me about 3 or 4 months before I realized he only had a month more sobriety than I did. And I was stunned when I found that out, because when he was helping me, he seemed to know what he was talking about. So since that time, I've watched him a lot to see how he did it. And what I've come to learn about him is that he goes to meetings. When he's at a meeting, he talks about the solution. He's always working with others, and he never shirks from service. And I want to hear how he did it, so I'm very pleased to present Rich P.
Wow, I can't wait to find out who's speaking tonight. Good evening, everyone. I'm a recovered alcoholic named Rich Paul.
Hey, Rich.
My sobriety date is June 24th, 2011, and the Central Orlando group is my home group, and it's good to be home. I'm just going to comment real briefly on that. I say recovered because I was taught by my sponsor in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that when I got started here, I had an opportunity. I had an opportunity to recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And through this program, that's exactly what I've been able to do. I'll never be cured of alcoholism. I know I can never pick up a drink again. But I've recovered to the state of point where I can stand in front of you, not be quaking and needing a drink. So let's begin at the beginning. I was born May 31st, 1988, in a steel town called Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. I was the first of two sons, born to two loving parents, upper middle class family, and I had nothing to complain about. Privately educated my whole life, I had a great childhood. My brother's not an alcoholic, my parents aren't an alcoholic, I don't have any alcoholic cousins, or aunts and uncles, or grandparents. And to be quite honest, I'm pretty thankful about that, because an alcoholic of my type, I'd figure out later, would have used any excuse to blame somebody else for my issues. And if I had an alcoholic relative, I know I would have used that one. That's for sure. Growing up, I always felt very different. I never felt that I really fit in. If you were looking at me, you were definitely talking about me. And if you were talking about me, it definitely wasn't good. So, you know, obviously, everyone was talking about me, and none of it was good. And that had me on my toes constantly. I never knew who to trust, and for that reason, didn't really trust. You know, I a few times tried to be vulnerable about my own beliefs to people, and when people didn't agree, I would meet that with fear from them, but it would come out in the form of anger or making fun of me. So I learned early on to put walls up to protect myself. Whether what I was saying was true, a lie, indifferent, the message that I received was protect yourself no matter what. Now, I'm not saying that's right, wrong, or indifferent. That's just what my journey is. I spent a lot of time in the elementary and middle school and even high school years trying to fit in. Fit into what I thought everyone wanted me to be. Fit into, you know, what would make me your buddy. Fit into what the girls would like. And as long as everyone else thought well of me, then it was all going to be okay. I cared a heck of a lot more what you thought about me than what I thought about myself. And, you know, it's funny, a number of people asked me today if I was nervous about getting up here to speak. And I said, you know, I'm really not. And that's not something I could have said back in the day. Because tonight's not about me. I might be up here telling my story. But tonight's about you, and you, and you. Whether you're here for your first time, whether you're here for thousands of times. You know, if I get nervous up here, I'm just stroking my ego, worried about what you think about me. We're here tonight for each of you. We're here tonight that if you're feeling hopeless, maybe you can grab onto some hope. I have no idea what I'm going to say tonight, but I know exactly what I'm going to talk about at the same time. My higher power is going to take care of all that, so if you don't like anything I have to say, make sure to mention that in your prayers tonight. So as I was saying before, you know, growing up, I didn't have any reason to complain. I came from a loving family, a good education, but I felt completely alone. I could be in a room as large as this and feel absolutely devastatingly alone. You know, I was the kid who sat at the school dance on the sidelines because I was worried what you would think about me. And it was really tiring. It took a lot of energy to be in fear all the time. It took a lot of energy to remember what my lie was last time so that I'm building upon it so you don't catch me in my lie. And I didn't realize that at the time, but I was, you know, always tired, and I could never figure out why I was always so exhausted. It was because I was too busy playing all these games in my head. I was too busy thinking in my head. You know, most people will think about A, B, C in their day. I'm all the way to Z and thinking about next week and the year after and the worst possible situation. You know, I seem to skip, you know, A through Y. I already go to what's the worst possible. In my early teen years, 13, 14, I had some friends who had started drinking. They got busted on a school trip, and I thought that they were really dumb. I like to learn the rules so that I could figure out the best way to break them or bend them and not get caught or manipulate them or get you in trouble so everyone's looking at you and not me while I get away with something. I know none of you can relate to that. So, you know, what I decided, because I was smarter than everyone else, clearly, was that you know, I was just going to drink on vacations because then it was much more accessible to me. There was much less responsibility that have. I had a lot more latitude, and I really enjoyed it. You know, I'd love to tell you that my first drink was a really manly dark beer. I'm pretty sure it was a strawberry daiquiri with a little bit of rum on top. That's just the way it is. It didn't matter what it was. I think I even used at one point the rationalization that, you know, though they say if you eat and drink at the same time that you won't get, you know, silly. And well, probably a frozen drink would work for that, right? Because you're like eating and drinking at the same time. That'll work. It doesn't if anyone hasn't tried it before. But my point is, I thought I was smarter. I thought that if I just did it on vacations, I could get away with it. And I always knew where I wanted to go to college. It was a big party school, and I knew I would have plenty of time. I also always knew I wanted to join a fraternity. And that was because I had watched my dad growing up have a group of friends that would get together every year for the big game. They would go on ski trips every year. They would have each other's back when things, you know, were good, bad, or indifferent. And I wanted that so desperately. I wanted so desperately to have friends that I knew no matter what would have my back. I wanted so desperately to know people who I felt like I fit in and was accepted unconditionally. And what made sense to me was, well, join a fraternity when you get to college, because, you know, that I just kind of put that two and two together. So when I got to college, I watched people who had, you know, been drinking for a long time and decided to join in with the fun. The very first night I went out, there were tons of upperclassmen who were more than happy to give me as much alcohol as I wanted for free. There were great parties. I discovered drinking games, and I can be a bit of a competitive person. So add drinking, competition, and good-looking women, I'm definitely game. And that's how it started. Friday and Saturday nights were party nights. That's what I decided. That way, by Sunday, I could, you know, recover and get all my schoolwork done for the week. But then there's football on Sundays. And what goes better with NFL football and a bunch of fraternity guys inviting you to a whole bunch of different events and parties and beer and pizza? So Sunday became a drinking day. And, well, there's also football on Monday night. So guess what goes with NFL football on Monday night? More beer and pizza. And who really goes to class on Thursdays? Or excuse me, Fridays. I mean, nothing important ever happens on Fridays. There are no exams on Fridays. Only losers go to school on Fridays. So Thursday we can make a drinking night. Friday classes aren't important. So pretty quickly I went from two nights a week to only two nights a week I wasn't drinking. And it wasn't like that every week, but at most weeks it was at least three or four times a week, minimum. And Tuesday or Wednesday, didn't take much of an excuse. You know, when you go to a big party school with 20-something fraternities, eight sororities, and a whole bunch of other people, there's always a party. There's always someone who's ready to party. And you just got to text around and find where it is tonight. So it wasn't hard to find a reason to have a tequila Tuesday or a wasted Wednesday. And there would be times where I would be go through a few weeks, and I would try to go to bed one night. You know, maybe I had an exam the next day, maybe not. But I would try to go to bed one night without drinking. And I couldn't remember the last time I went to bed without drinking. And it was really hard for me to go to sleep. I couldn't go to sleep. I didn't know what the issue was. Unbeknownst to me, I'd become so used to drinking and having that put me to sleep that I didn't know how to fall asleep without it. So I joined the fraternity. And, you know, I wasn't one of those drinkers who was ever worried about where my next drink was coming from. I had a bar in my personal room. The fraternity had a beer closet. The fraternity had a liquor closet. And I knew as long as I didn't visit any of my friends at any other colleges, I didn't have to worry about where my drink was coming from, because the house was fully stocked, on tap, 24/7. And I built a wall around myself and stayed in that building for as much time as possible, occasionally going to classes, doing enough to get by. But, you know, those people who I thought wouldn't always have my back, you know, slowly started to recoil. You know, I had to have a lot of looks the next day of disgust, and I have no idea what that look was about. And people saying, "You owe me an apology," and I go, "For what?" I didn't remember. I'd kept drinking that night till I blacked out. I didn't even realize, you know, that blacking out wasn't a normal thing. You know, I surrounded myself with a lot of heavy drinkers just because, well, I want to drink all the time and I want people to drink with and play drinking games. So, yeah, of course that's who I'm going to hang out with. And it was a pretty common occurrence Sunday to get together with the guys, you know, swap war stories and help each other fill in the blanks of the weekend, of what each other did. And it became a joke to be able to top everybody's story, who had the best story, who did the most ridiculous thing. So I thought blacking out was normal. I thought everybody did it. I thought it was just a part of college. You know, when my parents would try to say something to me, I said, "Well, you went to that school too. You know, you partied. I know you did." But I didn't realize I was different. School became less of a priority. The girlfriend became less of a priority. Friends became less of a priority. Family became less of a priority. And I used all sorts of rationalizations, all sorts of jokes, all sorts of everything to, you know, distract myself, to rationalize, well, as long as I don't drink alone, I don't have a problem. Well, you don't have a problem with drinking until, at least till you graduate college. After you graduate college, if you keep this up, then it's inappropriate. But in college, it's okay. We make jokes like, AA is for quitters. Best detox is retox. Picking up another drink the next day. And it was all a joke to us. It was all a joke. Being called an alcoholic was like a sign, you know, like a badge of honor. It was saying that you could drink more than anybody else. You know, or you were up later more than anyone else. Because you were still drinking. And that's how I built self-worth in college. By being able to win drinking games. By being able to drink a lot. And that's how I made myself feel good about myself. And I didn't realize that's not what the rest of the world did. Somehow I graduated college. There's a lot of lying, cheating, and manipulating in there in the process. A lot of times I got other people to do work for me. A lot of times I copied other work. And occasionally I did some on my own. But I made it through college, and I decided that the problem was clearly that I needed to, you know, just go to a warmer climate. If I was in a warmer climate, it would all be okay. And I tried that. And when I got to Florida, I was terrified to go to clubs and bars because I didn't have any friends here to back me up. If I started mouthing off or I got into trouble, you know, I didn't have anyone to back me up or to bail me out of trouble. You know, all those times where I'd done something dumb and someone was there to get me out of trouble. And I didn't realize that normal people aren't afraid to go out in public and have a drink because of what they might say or do later. I would watch friends even in college. They would have a beer or two with dinner or play one drinking game and go do their paper or their homework. I knew the moment I took the first sip that it was over. I was not doing anything else for the rest of the night. I was probably not doing anything the next morning because more often than not, I would wake up drunk after a night of drinking. And I just rationalized it all. There came a point in my drinking where I went to a work function, had a couple with them, had a couple more with the guys afterwards, and by the time I blacked back in, it was 5 in the morning, you know, my credit card was gone, my debit card was gone, my keys were gone, and I was so bumbling around drunk that I couldn't even call or ask for help. You know, when the police and bums on the street don't want to talk to you, you've probably traveled pretty far down. When you're asking them for help and no one wants to be near you, you probably traveled pretty far down. At least I knew I had. And I wanted to rationalize the next day why it was somebody else's fault. It was my boss's fault because he was mad at me. It was my coworker's fault because, you know, I finally felt like I was fitting in with them, so I stayed in longer, and only if they had, you know, accepted me earlier, I wouldn't have stayed out drinking. And it was anyone's fault but mine. And apparently they didn't agree because they fired me. And I'm glad they did because it was the beginning of the end, but not quite the end. You know, I had to start a real crazy train across the United States where I went to D.C. to help my brother with some work for a little bit. And then I went to visit some friends in Ocean City, Maryland. And some of them were younger guys. They were graduating. They were fraternity brothers of mine. And I could never control my drinking and have fun. I could have a few if I really paid attention, really pushed hard, and really didn't have any fun, and then went somewhere and was miserable. But most of the time, I just kind of threw caution to the wind and just drank. And that was going to be one of those nights. I was upset, didn't have any friends in Florida, didn't have a job, didn't know how I was going to feed myself, you know, the next week. I felt trapped. You know, when I was drinking, I had this illusion of freedom. And when I wasn't drinking, I felt terrified, alone. I felt like I was in a lose-lose situation, and it was a cycle that just repeated and repeated and repeated. that night was a real solid blackout. When I'm told of the night before, you know, when I woke up, you know, I had a black eye to the point where I could barely open it. I actually didn't feel it right at first because I was still drunk from the night before, as usual. But there wasn't a part of my body that wasn't cut up, banged up, bruised up. I couldn't lay on any which way without being in pain. I had three fraternity brothers, one who was a football player, one who was a mixed martial artist, and one who just looks like a big old lumberjack from Pennsylvania. And it took the three of them holding me down that night because they were worried I was going to go out and hurt someone or hurt myself. It took the three of them holding me down that night for over an hour, and I still managed to kick down a door and the entire door frame. And I don't say that because I'm proud of it. I say that because that's the level of insanity that my alcoholism took me to. That's the level of insanity that I went to, and I didn't even know that there was anything wrong with me. And I was that close to just writing it off again. You know, walking around the place, doing the usual apologies, laugh it off, you know, you co-sign my bowl, I'll co-sign your bowl the next time you screw up. But clearly I didn't know how to fix a door frame, I'm not that handy. So I asked my uncle to come help me, and he came and fixed it up real quick. And I asked him, you know, how can I repay you? You know, I felt shame, he had to come bail me out, and he took time out of his work day and brought one of his employees to help him and everything. And he looked at me right in the eye and he said, never pick up a drink again. I don't think you can do it. But I know if you continue this way, you're going to be dead or in jail for 3 to 5 years. Guaranteed. He said he dated an alcoholic and he tried to help her and he tried to stay with her, but she didn't want to get sober and he couldn't stay anymore. So the next day I went to an AA meeting. There was a bunch of little old ladies, one toothless old man, and I was having a little bit of trouble identifying. But I was in a lot of pain. So I went to another meeting that night. And I didn't hear much of what they said, but when they said it was their first meeting, I raised my hand. And when they asked, does anyone have a desire to stop drinking, I got up and got a chip. And I, having not known none of these people at the end of the meeting, I was given my big book for free. These people I'd never met before. These people who knew nothing about me except that I was coming in with a black eye and reeking of alcohol as it seeped through my pores from the day before. That's all they knew. And they immediately they wanted to help me. I heard, just go to meetings and don't drink. So I said, okay, that sounds like a good plan. So I just went to meetings. I sat in the back, didn't come early, didn't talk to anyone on the way in, left immediately when it ended, didn't stay afterwards and talk to anyone, didn't like that G-O-D word on the wall, had already decided I wasn't going to make them amends to them all, because, you know, if you knew that ex-girlfriend and what she did to me, you wouldn't make amends to her either. My mind was very closed. So I went to a few meetings and continued my travel around the United States and looking for, well, maybe I'll just move to California. That'll be the ticket. And I did have a nice little drive up and down California, but the problem was I wanted to die. I didn't want to die because I really wanted to die. I wanted to die because the cycle, I couldn't stop it. Dying was the only thought of the idea of how I could stop this cycle that I was caught in. And I've actually gotten to the point where it wasn't, am I going to kill myself or not? It was to the point where, you know, I feel like I can't do anything for my family except kill myself so that they can collect the insurance money. A few days before, my brother, who is my favorite person in the world, still is, he, you know, called me a mean, violent drunk in front of his friends. And I was mad at him. I was thinking, why would he say such a thing? And he told me, I love you, but if we met on the street, we wouldn't be friends. I don't like you. I love you because you're my brother, but that's about it. This is my favorite person in the world saying that to me. I watched a lot of friends or friends' parents commit suicide growing up, so it was always a very serious thing in my family. And I'd always had a promise to my parents if I was ever, you know, going to do something, I'd say something. And I had to have that phone call with my mom where I had to tell her to let go. I had to tell her I didn't know what was going to happen. I couldn't promise her I wouldn't do anything. And then she had to let go. I sat in that motel outside of Santa Barbara, California, going, is this it? Having this little chat with my higher power of sorts that I had. Is this where I die? Is this how the story ends? I just didn't see any other options. Fortunately, something inside me... Well, to be quite honest, I hadn't figured out the best way to kill myself yet, to be quite honest. I'd love to tell you I had an epiphany, but that just ain't the truth. I hadn't figured out the best way to kill myself so that they could get the maximum insurance money. You know, I'd even had my uncle draft up a will before I'd left town. And I got back to Orlando. And, you know, I said, well, you know, what's this sponsor thing and how does it work? And the chairperson, who was a woman, was more than happy to show me to the door and show me where all the men were outside after the meeting. And, you know, I said, well, you know, I'm thinking about getting a sponsor, but I need a sponsor who's like this, and he needs to have this type of spiritual beliefs, and he needs to have XYZ criteria to be my sponsor. And the guy looks at me and goes, dude, you're not going to marry him. Just pick a sponsor, start working the steps. It doesn't work for you, just pick a new one. It's all about you trying to get sober anyway. They won't be mad. I'd carried my big book with me for about 9,000 mile trip around the United States for a solid month without opening it once. But something he said made sense. So in that group of guys, I picked up a sponsor and I started working the steps. It was really easy for me to acknowledge that I was powerless over alcohol, because I knew the moment it entered my body, who knew what was going to happen next. Having a scavenger hunt for all my stuff the next day after a blackout was a normal occurrence. But managing my own life? I don't have a DUI yet. That guy lives under a bridge. She's lost her children. So maybe I'm not doing as bad as them. So maybe I'm doing okay with managing my life. And it was explained to me that, you know, it's not about how you're different from people. It's about how you're similar. So I went back into a different mindset when I went listened in a meeting. Lost a job? Yup. Girl gone? Yup. Friends gone? Yup. Multiple family members gone? Yep. Suddenly it started to sink in, and yeah, my life wasn't manageable. And step two was pretty easy for me. You know, when I saw the God word, I had a certain overtone, certain ideas of what I thought that higher power was. And that was my problem. Had I, just left my mind a little more open and read the rest of the sentence, it talks about God as I understand him. Which I'd been doing my whole life anyway, so why not? So I couldn't manage my life, and someone else was offering to do it? Absolutely, you can have it. I'd ran it into the ground. So I asked my sponsor how we were going to do step three, you know, how do I make that decision to turn my will and my life over? And we took a knee, and we said the third step prayer. And I got pretty comfy then. You know, I'd started to meet some people in the rooms. People smiled at me when I came to a meeting. They shook my hand. Met some nice young people who would go to coffee with me and whatnot. And I was content to sit there. What I didn't know was I started doing the steps backwards. All of a sudden I was on step three, where I'd turned my will and my life over. And then I was on step two. And then I was on step 1B. And then I was on step 1A. I'd given all that stuff back. I was managing my life. And, you know, one night I was devastated because I thought I had hurt somebody who meant a lot to me. after getting sober, and I almost drank again. I was making those 1, 2, 3 a.m. phone calls. And not long after that, my sponsor texted me, you're going to need to find a new sponsor because I can't help you if you're not going to do this. My very first thought was, I can do this on my own. The next thought was, absolutely not. I have no resentment towards that sponsor. They did the best thing they could for me. They found a way to get in my butt in gear and motivate me how I wasn't motivated before. Fortunately, I'd been working with a gentleman to help bring a young person's meeting to a local university that really felt that they needed an AA meeting. It actually still sends chills down my body, but the same day that our group was approved and we met for that group business meeting was the same day that someone died in an alcohol-related incident the night before on that campus. So I knew this man, and I got a hold of him and asked if he would sponsor me. And he said, okay, well, you're going to listen to this big book study every day for 30 minutes with your book open and a writing implement. If they say circle, you circle. If they say highlight, you highlight. If they say underline, you underline. I said, okay. But I'm on step 4. No, you're not. You're on step 1. I said, okay. You're going to read the doctor's opinion, the spiritual experience. I said, well, I already read it. Okay, read it again. He wanted to see if I was willing. Now, the book talks about if somebody's not willing, move on to the next person. But there's someone dying for help. And I can't waste my time if someone doesn't want help. Because there's someone else dying out there who really does. So I got my butt in gear. And I did the first 3 steps. And with a week, I'd done my 4th step, and we were doing my 5th step. And I always thought it was going to be really painful, but when I sat down to do it, everything just came streaming out. Everything just came streaming out so naturally. And all those terrible things that I was never going to tell anyone, that I was going to take to the grave, those things weren't going to fly. He wanted all those too. And he'd done most, if not all, the things that I've done. And as the instructions in this textbook called Alcoholics Anonymous said, I went home for an hour and I looked at the first 5 proposals, the first 5 steps, to see if I left anything out. And he told me, if I don't hear from you in an hour, then I know you'll have taken steps 6 and 7, or I'm asking my higher power to take it away. And the most miraculous thing happened when I did the 7-step prayer. I asked that my defects of character were taken away and my obsession to drink was gone. I never thought that that would happen in 12 steps, let alone 7. I hadn't asked him for him to take that, but clearly there was some sort of defect of character he wanted to take, and I wasn't going to argue. And that obsession hasn't come back since. It was really easy to make my 8-step list because I just had to rewrite my 4-step list and be told how I was going to make my amends. And I don't know about your higher power, but my higher power has an awesome sense of humor. Because there was a family reunion the week that my amends were, I got to the 9th step. You know, including a cousin that I'd had a drunken fight with the night before his wedding. Including a cousin that I wasn't invited to his wedding after the performance of the last one. And I made my amends. And then, you know what? They were a lot harder in my mind than they were in person. And they went a heck of a lot better than I thought they were going to go. And I asked my sponsor, when are we going to do step 10? How about right now? So I take a daily inventory so I don't have to carry the weight of a 4-step that I used to carry. And I said, well, how about when are we going to do 11? He said, how about now? It's all about just prayer and meditation. Those are 2 separate topics. I was combining them as 1. 2 separate things that I needed to do every day to get closer touch with my higher power. And then I would ask, okay, well, you know, what about step 12? And he said, well, have you had a spiritual awakening? Well, I said, well, yeah, I don't want to drink anymore. That pretty much counts as a spiritual awakening for me. He said, all right, go carry the message. And I said, well, you know,
isn't there things like you have to be like a year sober or da 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 da? And he said, can you flip to the textbook page about a year sober? I was 3 months sober at the time when I got through my steps. And he actually referred me to a page in the back, which was a story I was telling some friends about earlier tonight. It was written by a guy named Earl Trent. He got sober in February of 1938. And his sponsor was Dr. Bob. And it's very challenging for me to argue with Dr. Bob. I've only found one place in the entire big book where it talks about a timeline for the steps. And Earl recounts how in one afternoon, in 3 to 4 hours, Dr. Bob took him through all the steps. So my sponsor told me, technically, you're like 3 months behind. So you better get to it. It was also told to me that service was important from day one. That everyone had something to give. You know, the person who has 10 years sober maybe is looking at the person who has 5, who's looking to the 1, who's looking to the 6 months, who's looking to the 3 months, who's looking to the 10 days, who's looking to the 1 day. And the guy who has 30 years is looking to the 1 day because he's reminding him that, yep, it's still terrible out there. The names of the drinks have changed, but it's still the same effect. It's still the same problems. It's still the same outcome. I was taught everyone could be of service. Even if it was me just calling someone to complain, I was being of service to them because I was giving them an opportunity to get outside of their own head. I was giving them an opportunity to be of service. When I looked around, there was service to be done all over the place, whether it was making coffee in a home group or holding the door or even just greeting people who were brand new. Watching someone who's brand new, who's coming maybe for their second or third time, and you remembered their name, their face just lights up. There's a lot of ways to do 12-step work. Personally, I love sponsoring. The book talks about it, something to the effect of being one of the highlights of our life, something you shouldn't miss. And I couldn't agree more. Watching the light come back on in someone's eyes from that darkness they walk in with. I can't get anyone sober. I can't get anyone drunk. But man, to watch them get sober, that's awesome. That's one of the most awesome things that I've gotten to witness. So talking to newcomers after a meeting, that's where I want to be. I want to be with the person who still reminds me, yep, it's still terrible out there. Yep, if you do that, you might get in trouble. You know, that helps me keep my sobriety fresh all the time. You know, I don't respect the guys who have 10, 20, 30, 40 years of sobriety because that's how long they've taken not taken a drink. I respect the guys who have 10, 20, 30 years of sobriety who are earning it again every single day. They're not too proud or too, you know, puffed up to go hold the door or to talk to the newcomer afterwards or give somebody a ride to detox or chair a meeting or get active in their home group or any number of service opportunities. They're the people who are still practicing the steps in their affairs. There are people who are still taking this message, the message in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a beautiful thing to watch, and it's a beautiful thing to be a part of. I've gotten to meet so many amazing people and do so many amazing things that I could be here all night talking about it, and we wouldn't even get halfway through. You know, at 2.5 months sober, I decided to tag along to a Ficky Paw host committee meeting. I had no idea what it was, but I had some friends whose sobriety I respected and knew they were doing service, so I came along, and before I knew it, I had a service position at a conference that was in a month. I was the co-chair of the security committee. Go figure. You know, I've had the opportunity to be active in my home group and chair a meeting. I've had the opportunity to work as an archivist for my group. And I don't say any of these things because I'm someone special or smarter or different. than any of you. You know, we all have these opportunities. When I get an opportunity, like I said, it's not because I'm smarter or different. It's not because I'm special that I'm, you know, up here. It's because I followed the instructions in the book. And every time I'm asked to be of service, it gives me an opportunity to dig in deeper. Every time I'm asked to be of service, it gives me an opportunity to get to know somebody better, to dig into the big book deeper, to study the traditions deeper. You know, it was great to be able to be in a room helping do a tradition seminar. There are guys who had been studying the traditions since before I was born, but I was presenting on a couple of the traditions. Once again, not because I knew anything, but just so it would get me involved and get me to study them. Because I knew if I was getting up in front of people who'd been studying the traditions for that long, I better get on my game a little bit. I know that I can go to pretty much any city in Florida, and I already know young people there, or AA members. I know I can go to pretty much any city in the world and find an AA meeting and be welcome and sit down in that chair. And the message is the same. The details of our story are different, but I can relate to everyone, every real alcoholic when they share. I can relate to every one of them. I used to get a sense of ease and comfort from a drink. Today when I travel and I come home, I'm not home when I pull into the apartment complex. I'm not home when I walk in the door. I'm not home even when I lay down in my own bed that night. I'm home the moment I walk into my home group and sit down into one of these oh-so-comfortable plastic white chairs. It may seem silly, but that's pretty much the most comfortable place in the world for me. Because I know I'm home. And I know I'm in a group of people just like me. And generally I'm accepted unconditionally, but even if I'm not, it's okay today. Because today I care a lot more about what I think about me than what you think about me. Today that's okay. It's a wonderful experience just to look around the room. Just to look around the room. Here's a room full of people who aren't drinking right now. See all your smiling faces. You know, people say things like, stay till a miracle happens. Personally, I see miracles every day. As long as I'm open to my higher power and I'm paying attention spiritually, if you will, I get to see them every day. I get to see newcomers come in off the street every day. I get to see people who, including myself, their normal instinct for most of their life was to hide, are all of a sudden reaching their hand out to somebody or going to talking to somebody when it's uncomfortable. I know that I'm safe today from a drink based on if I'm involved in the steps, I'm involved with my sponsor, I'm involved with service, I'm involved with my higher power, and I'm making sure I'm getting my information from my textbook. Then I don't have to worry about a drink. I know if I follow those things, my higher power's got it taken care of for me. And that was something I never thought possible. Never in a million years. So if you take anything away from tonight, please dig in. Whether you're a day sober or 40-some years sober, I've found from the men that I learned from that there's always more to learn. There's so much rich information in the big book. You can literally study it line by line and still miss stuff again and again. I swear they're putting new stuff in this book all the time, even though it hasn't been changed since, 70 plus years. Dig in to your home group and be of service. Dig in and get to know other people. Carry the message, this message, the one in the big book. I don't have to reinvent the wheel. It's already been done for me. I don't have to try tons of crazy new methods, or I don't have to have brilliant new ideas of how to get somebody sober, or this idea might work great for my next sponsee. I know it worked for me. And I know what worked for the 100 or so people who helped write this book. So I just keep it simple and keep it to their directions. And if I keep it to their directions, they promise me more than 100 things of what will happen. I always get nervous when I see complex things. I want to freak out. I want to hide, repress, deny. But when I actually take a look at them, they're not so bad. When I actually take a look at them, it's a lot easier than I thought it would be. And that's how it was with this program. When I actually took a look at the words in the book, when I actually listened to a man who was willing to walk me through the steps, everything was a lot simpler and slowed down and was a lot easier. It's not always easy, but it's real simple. And all of my problems today, I can find an answer in the big book. All of my problems. It may take me a little while to find it, but all of them. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you.